and you cannot fulfill your needs as a social creature. So exposure is actually given by Eden and to Exia.
Well, what, once again, to refer to what George pointed out, and again, I'd love to have David mention whether this is true or not. This is a supposition on my part. I think, unfortunately, we got a little distracted when David mentioned his own interest in audio-visual. He's setting something up for someone else, I think, who simply wants to reproduce music. I do not think they want to originate music and therefore share the music they're originating. I think they have files of music, I might be wrong, that they would like to reproduce in a pleasant way for a reasonable price. Now, I would appreciate, David, if you could kind of say yay or nay and hopefully kind of narrow this conversation somewhat.
QSL Roy, I have an audio-visual system, Pro Audio, here. I've had it for many years. The person who wanted me, who wants me to set up some kind of playback, he wants the same quality coming out of those speakers. You know, he says, I want to have something like what you have. So I said, well, this is what you need to get. You need speakers, you need this sub bass, you need this audio interface. And my question for Rich was, there is an audio interface called PreSonus, PreSonus Studio 24C. I want to know if that is a good interface in terms of like what people use and what they know. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll call again if WB2GXM is around. PreSonus is a company that sells software. So this is more of a multi-track control device for a digital analog converter device. It's not the hardware, as far as I am aware. It is primarily software. But Rich, GXM, if you're back, if you have any kind of experience or know anything about PreSonus, David would really appreciate your input.
No, Roy, it is a piece of hardware, and it also comes with software for Mac or PC.
Okay, so I guess they also sell audio interfaces and controllers and different modules that kind of fit into the bigger picture. But I have no idea what their price points are. I assume that they are significant.
Well, this one's inexpensive. It's the same price as Scarlett 2i2. The problem is the person that I'm setting up for, he doesn't like the red color of the interface for the Scarlett. So I said, well, maybe I can give you one that's blue instead.
Well, I'm a little confused. The Scarlett comes in different colors, I thought. There were different qualities of the hardware, and I thought the whole trick with them is... You know, I think there's a blue one, there's a purple one. It sort of depends upon the price point.
Negative. That's not what I saw. At least looking in this catalog, you know, for music-related equipment and instruments and things like that, you know, they're all these Scarletts were Scarlett. They were all Scarlett. And, I mean, I would have taken it, but... This person didn't want the Scarlett color, so I offered him one that's blue instead.
Okay. I guess people can have aesthetic sensibilities.
QSL sell, and he was also very particular on the length of the audio cables. You know, these cables from interface to subwoofer are TRS standard plugs, so they're balanced cables, and then from the subwoofer to the speakers are balanced XLR cables. Also, the subwoofer has a low cut function where you select between two frequencies to remove the bass from the regular speakers. Subwoofer should be able to provide that bass.
Okay, that makes perfect sense to me. I'm a little bit confused. XLRs are balanced connectors. What are the other balanced connectors that you were talking about? Because phone connectors aren't balanced.
TRS phone connectors.
Okay. I realize they could be twisted pairs and such, but I don't know if they're really generally thought of as really balanced cables.
These connectors have three connections, and on both sides, and if the equipment is set up for that, then it would be a balanced connection. If I have any problems with it, I'm sure, you know, I can get assistance from the tech support at the Sweetwater.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Roy. Yeah, TRS is tip ring shield, naturally, so... You know, it refers to a shield, which would make it a balanced cable.
Okay. Again, you know, there's a lot of very good choices. You know, it's kind of like radios. You know, there isn't one particular company that makes the only good radios out there. So, you know, they're different color schemes. To me personally, I guess I don't have as much aesthetic sensibility. That's the least of my problems, what color it is. But I go more for the specifications, the options, and the price point. Like I said before, there's a lot of interesting software and hardware out there. And as long as you stick with legitimate companies and you check out their specifications, they usually, in my experience, don't fib on things like that. You probably can't go wrong.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
A tip ring shield is balanced depending upon the frequency and the actual application of it. But tip ring without any voltage on it is balanced.
I don't see how tip ring can be balanced because those are just two connectors. If you have three connectors and the way that you've made the wiring is a kind of a twist, you know, twisted pair, so that the signal's differential mode cancel out any kind of external noise. I think the only point I was making was a tip ring sleeve can be balanced, but it also can be unbalanced depending upon the design parameters of the wire. But I don't see how you could design a tip ring that would be balanced because it's just two wires. And XLRs, if you notice, are three wire conductor connections.
Yeah, the audio, KD2FIU, audio over telephone networks for almost 100 years was balanced audio, chip and ring.
to 20 kilohertz, right? So a very low frequency.
Hold on. KD2FIU. That's between 400 and 4,000 hertz audio.
Okay, I don't think anyone would like a sound system that bandwidth is 400 to 4,000. But the whole point of between balanced and unbalanced is if you were to put some RF noise into the line, balanced wires would kind of balance them out. You'd get the same interference on both sides, so the difference between the two would be zero, so you would be protected from the outside currents. Whereas if you only have two wires and you expose them to some kind of external field, much easier for them to pick up the RF noise. That's my understanding of why people like balanced audio.
Well, no, KD2FIU, I wanted to finish this thought here because there's many different attempts to this technology. And let's go back to some basics here. You can have two-wire balanced, and you can have signals over it, and you don't have the noise. The concept is that the two wires were designed to be put with the ability to reject the noise, the RF noise, between a certain frequency spectrum. So we can't just drift out and say that this is the way it's supposed to be.
Yes, Wesley.
Okay, we were mentioning Focusrite and Scarlett and TRS and XLR. So Focusrite is the company, Scarlett is the product, and depends from how many ports it has. It's 2i2 or 8i8 and so on. But the connectors are for both. So you have XLR with built-in TRS inside. Many devices use it. Now, I strongly oppose that this is for kilohertz only, because usually the phone connector, which is TRS, is used for the guitars or any kind of sources that traditionally use TRS. The beauty of the device that is made by Focusrite, which is the Scarlett, is that it could accommodate almost the same condition for both. If you have a guitar that is a very high pitch, it's going to play it with no distortion. How do they do it is the question. How do they make both of those, the TRS built into inside of the XLR, so you can exchangeably change the connector or to change the device that is connected to it, that I don't know. And to XGM.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George recognized, but just one second. Just for the sake of complicating things even more. You'll thank me later. The Scarlett Solo does not actually use the connector that's capable of operating as both an XLR and a one-quarter phone. For whatever reason, design or otherwise, they have a separate XLR connection in the front and a separate one-quarter inch phono. And as a completely off-topic aside, my Flex Radio has an XLR / one-quarter phone dual connector type of device in the rear that I use to connect my PR40 microphone to. George, please, your turn.
Okay, you're talking about modular devices connected to other modular devices. With your radio and its microphone, that's modular device to modular device. So when you're talking about tip ring and sleeve, you're talking about a balanced audio signal and utilizing the sleeve not only for ground, but for capacitive deflection over distances between the next device. That device does not include audio modulated or even RF modulated network or trunking. That includes what the signal is going to pass through to the next device. So tip ring and sleeve does include a balanced tip and ring. The sleeve is going to contain information. Information to be transferred, and also a very, very high resistive, low capacitive passing of balancing between the tip and ring.
Okay, George. Once again, I think we really veered away from David's subject. Rich, WB2GXM, had to leave us tonight. I hope he will return next Sunday night for the next episode of this. But getting back to you, David, I'm sorry, but GXM isn't going to be able to answer your question on that company's products. I'm sorry. Worst comes to worst, if you want to try, I think he's on QRZ. You could email him and ask him his opinion.
QSL, thanks. And I asked the tech support people what cables that they would recommend. And they said with this unit and the Yamaha HF subwoofer that I should get TRS quarter-inch cables, two of them, for balanced audio transmission.
Comment?
Yes, please comment.
This is KD2UAH, Rocco. I just want to say, these names that we're throwing around, Yamaha and all this other stuff. I'm a real audiophile. I've been one for 30 years, and I've invested a lot of money in audio equipment. At best, these brands are mid-fi equipment. Sony, Denon, these are all mid-fi things. And, if this gentleman is interested, the station's interested in the most high-quality reproduction, a Yamaha subwoofer is not really that well-regarded, and it's not really an audiophile piece of equipment. So, at best, he's only going to get mid-fi sound. That's just my two cents. KD2, UAH, and back to the group.
I agree.
Well, I agree as well, Rocco, but the reality is not everyone has the same ears as each other. So if your hearing is so good and your experiences and ability to discern high quality audio from medium quality, and you have the money to back it up, then yeah, sure. There's a level of diminishing returns with high fidelity equipment. And a lot of times people will buy stuff that with better specs than their ears will ever hear. So, I'm sure you've met guys who have expensive equipment who couldn't hear the difference between anything.
Roy, there was a double between you and David. KD2FI, you're all staying clear.
No, real.
Okay, unfortunately, David, you doubled with me, then I let go, and George told me that you doubled with me and you were doubling with him. So let me just ask this question of Rocco, because, I think he spent a significant amount of money, it sounds like, getting a really high-quality audio. But, haven't you met people who kind of show off the price of their components and don't really have decent ears between their head?
Oh, I
agree with that, Roy. I do. But the thing is, I guess as we're all getting older, it's probably not going to matter all that much anyway, because you nailed a good point. I don't think I'm probably about as, you know, your age, and my ears are not as good as they were 30 years ago. But I can tell you that, you know, when you're a dedicated audiophile, I'll let it drop. The difference is amazing. I mean, I've gone back to vinyl, and I mean, yes, you can spend, you know, $20,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 on a turntable, but you can also buy a turntable for $400 or $500 with $100 cartridge. You just have to know what you're buying. That's the thing. And I think that, you know, David might do well, especially if he's in the city, you know, going into some of the audio places and just talking to some of the guys that can steer you into some of the lesser expensive equipment, not spending big numbers, that will still give you a better sound than a, you know, department store, or, you know, a brand. And that was my point before. Not that I want to be an audio snob, but if you talk to the right people, you know, you can get stuff that, you know, like wine. You don't have to spend $100 on a bottle of wine. You can get a $20 bottle of wine that probably tastes just as good.
Absolutely agree.
I have to say that most of my stereo gear is old, discarded, repaired, and it sounds amazing. You know, I'm not so interested, you know, to spend $100,000 on a stereo. I built mine for mostly junk, and it sounds amazing. So how do you even measure that?
With great difficulty, David. And so, you know, it's in the eyes of whoever it is. The person that you're recommending a sound system, if they like the quality of your sound system, I would let that guide your decision-making. You know, some people have beautiful hearing. They can discern the difference between things that I couldn't even imagine. Rocco mentioned it with wine. You could do that even with espresso. There are news groups where people, or Reddit groups nowadays, where people extol the virtue of coffee in an obsessive manner. And you can spend $20,000 buying just an espresso machine and a grinder. You can spend $500 getting a decent cup of espresso as well. Depends upon a whole bunch of factors. So I think since your associate likes your the quality of your sound system, I think that should guide your decisions on what components would make up a sound system comparable.
I think we're going off base for this. You know, this is a sound system for a computer. You know, my friend already has Macintosh components, huge JBL, vintage JBL speakers, and all that stuff, you know. This is just for his computer room, you know, computer audio, and that's it. Using iTunes and playing playlists.
Okay. Again, you could do this expensive, you could do this inexpensive, you can do it someplace in the middle. Most of these digital to analog converter components are reasonably good quality. They have reasonably good specs. There are some people out there who don't want to deal with digital conversion at all. They don't believe that digital sound is the same as analog sound, that something gets lost. The same thing happened when consumer electronics shifted from tubes to transistor solid state. There are people who don't want solid state audio equipment. They feel that there's a certain warmth and quality to vacuum tubes, and the same thing to vinyl, and the same thing to every medium. So, you know, you got to know your audience. You got to know his price point. All those things being equal, We did veer all over the place. We did enter into the philosophy net and a whole bunch of other things. But, you know, I hope we gave you something to think about, and I hope the people listening learned something on the subject in case they didn't know much about digital-to-analog converter devices available for computers.
Yes, yes, I'm very thankful. And it was very nice to, you know, throw this whole thing around.
Very good. Wesley, do you have any kind of closing comment to make on this? Because, you know, we've bounced it around for an hour and a half. I think we bounced it enough.
Yeah, I happened to have a conversation with one of the guys working with Adorama, who is a musician, but he's working at Adorama, and the other one is working in B&H in video. But he's also a musician, but he's working on a video. Both of those guys, they say, well, it looks like we are in the place where the general public can come in and buy anything that they want. But actually, it turns out that a professional comes in. So people who need some audio, some video, or some photography equipment, and they are professionals doing money on it, or hobbies, they know what they're buying. So Yamaha or Denon became a big name. It became actually the not the quality, but actually the name companies. And that's why I agree that the quality of it, comparing to the price, is not necessarily a good one. But when you go with Sony or Sanyo, it was, or Panasonic, but when you go to the professional stuff, it comes that those professionals buy it for quite low amount of money comparing to other equipment, and it's really good. Now, also you mentioned that the Focusrite has the Scarlett has different colors. Now, all of the Scarletts are in red, and the one that you used that was XLR only, that was probably a solo version of Focusrite. The closing comment of mine is there was everything excellent on the market, everybody could buy it, but the plumber knows what to buy and what to use it for the customer, but the customer doesn't know it. The same is with a musician, the same is with the video guy or the film guy. The professional stuff is not necessarily very expensive, but you have to know what you're buying. Thank you.
Okay, very good. I think we put this one to bed, and let me ask, I hope Sam is still with us. KD2NSJ, are you still there, Sam?
Yes, well, I'm here. I wouldn't leave you all for nothing. I learned a lot, but I don't know where to put it. My question was, I was listening to Wayne and the guys doing Polar, on the air, okay? And they were at the park. All of a sudden I heard the guy in California come back to Wayne. I couldn't hear nothing Wayne was saying, and I couldn't hear anybody else. Does HF normally do that you can't hear each other, but you can hear other things?
All the time.
Thank you, Ed. That's called Skip, by the way. If you ever look at nice little pictures of electromagnetic wave propagation in the ionosphere, you can sort of get a sense of what's going on. It climbs up to the ionosphere. It reflects and refracts back down, hits the ground, sometimes bounces back up, goes back into the ionosphere, and does it all over again. So there are patches where the RF is not anywhere near the ground where you can't hear people. It's very common to have skip locally where you don't hear the local guy, but you hear the guy who's responding to the local guy, you know, 500, 1,000 miles away. But, Ed, if you want to expand upon that, please feel free.
WB2EAV. There are books and books written on the subject of HF propagation. But the bottom line is, for all intents and purposes, it is random, it is undecipherable, and any attempt you try to make to game the system will drive you into the loony bin.
Thank you, Ed. Now this subject confounds the most learned amateur radio operator that's out there, where every so often, for whatever reason, they put up a new antenna or a new radio, or they're curious, and they have some guy on the repeater, and they say, I'm going to go down to 40 meters. I want to know if you hear me. And the usual response is, no, they don't hear you, because the only thing that you get locally in the range of the repeater is ground wave propagation. If you have a lot of structures that are blocking you, you're not going to get there. So it's those wonderful ionospheric refractions and reflections that allow us to get those distant communications, and they change. They're always subject to change. The ionosphere you should not think of as just a static layer in the sky that turns on or off. You should really think of it as a turbulent stream of an ocean, if you will, with waves, calm portions, and waves, and rivers that ebb and flow, and all kinds of fun stuff. So propagation conditions can change on a dime. You could be talking clearly to a guy in Texas, and then all of a sudden you can't hear him to save your life. So that's one of the variables that I think attracts a lot of people to this hobby. I think if amateur radio transmissions were as dependable as cell towers and cell phones, people would get bored rather quickly.
KD2FIU.
Yes, unfortunately, George, I think you doubled with Ed. So Ed first and then George.
There is a secret to eternal happiness on the HF band. Turn it on, listen, and anything you work is pure gravy. And if it's DX, so much the better. But don't try to predict, just go with the flow.
Again, I would agree with my learned friend there. You can look at all kinds of solar charts for sunspot activity, and you can look at all kinds of web-based information of beacons and reverse beacons and people reporting in that they've made contact. Ultimately, the most important thing to have with a good operating practice is a lot of good luck. So you just go out there and you listen, you throw out your call occasionally, and sometimes the fish lands on the hook, and sometimes it doesn't.
By the way, those same rules apply to fishing, too.
Yes, and the best analogies are the ones that are accurate for both. George, you wanted to say something on the subject.
Double, you turn it over to you, George.
KD2FIU, Ed, I would have to agree, enjoy it. Enjoy whatever you can do with your antenna and your radio, and especially any time during the high point or the low point of the sunspot cycle. Because it doesn't matter. Build it and let it work. Let me let it drop here. In the early days of long distance, AT&T long lines, starting probably right after World War One, was working on HF. HF, now they were not only able to switch calls by people transferring calls between jack boards and stuff like that, but they were switching them with massive field stirber curtains set up in different rural areas at high points around the country. So to put together the long distance call, not only was the operator putting your call through on jacks, but there were technicians who were putting the calls through on which fields of energy were available through massive stirber curtain antenna systems that were available in different areas, and mostly in rural areas and sometimes outside of cities, so that they were able to make the long distance hop via HF radio, whether it was a high point or a low point in the sunspot cycles. They were taking advantage of low band activity and medium band activity and the bottom of HF band activity. So that's where we can actually say to any operator, go ahead, build your equipment, you're licensed for, and do it. KG2FYU.
KG2R1.
Yes, David.
Well, you know, George has a point. You know, we take advantage when the band is open. And you got to listen a few times a day. Sometimes the band is open only for a short time. And when I hear signals on the band, they're loud enough for me to hear them. I can call and perhaps have some kind of conversation, you know. And so, like I've said to a number of stations, you know, I have to be very thankful for the propagation, you know, because I have a minimal ham radio setup there.
To FIU.
Yes, George.
I just wanted to direct this to Ed, please. Ed, you know I started with long lines in 71.
Go ahead, George.
Yeah, it was all radio towers at that point. And from there, within 10 years, we're working all fiber optics. But just to bring it back to right after World War One, how it was done, we took the idea was to take advantage of the low band, mid-band, and HF. And if you ever heard the expression in some very, very old movies, give us a few minutes to set up your call. It was more than an operator. It was actually what band and what frequency long lines is going to be working through their towers. And it could have gone through different frequency bands to work it. So, Ed, I told you about this sometime earlier. Thank you for listening. KD2FIU.
Yeah, that's the way they did it.
I'm up right.
Yes, Sam.
Thank you, Ed, about the books, because that's what I was reading. I didn't understand what I'm reading, you know. I need to talk to somebody to explain it. Thank you, George, also. Now, the other part, real quick,
that I'm in is, what makes the difference of a complete wave or half a wave, like they said, 36, whatever, the distance? The longer the wire, the more bands you can get in. Why?
Well, I don't know if it's that simple that you could just get in more. Antennas really work best if they're cut for resonant or odd multiples of a half wave. So the first is a half wave dipole. Theoretically, if you built a three halves dipole, it would be nice and resonant for that frequency, and on and on. There are modes of operation where antennas can decently be resonant at other frequencies, especially at odd multiples of the frequency. So it's a little bit more complicated. You know, if what you said was kind of the rule, the trick would be to build the longest piece of wire you can for as far as you can, and then everything would be lovely and resonant, which it isn't.
Okay, I got the picture now. And now I understand why I couldn't hear Wayne. But I did hear the guy call back to Wayne, and then I didn't hear him call back, and now I understand Skip. So Skip is a real tricky thing, you got it right. The other thing was, you got a long wire, okay, that's a complete wave. How does the, I know it sounds crazy, how do the other bands get in there, and then if you have a short one, they can't get in there?
Oh, okay, this gets rather complicated, speaking about it without any pretty pictures. What you have is a conductor. The conductor will interact with electromagnetic fields that are near it. It will preferentially resonate at a resonant frequency. So if you have a piece of if you have a half wave dipole and you have an electromagnetic wave that's that half wave length, it'll resonate like a spring or a seesaw that you get the right rhythm to, or a pendulum where you get the right rhythm to, and the energy kind of gets soaked up like a battery. Then it gets transferred into your receiving circuits, and you receive the signal, and then you can transmit and back and forth. So what you're looking for is an electronic version of resonance that occurs in sound waves and all kinds of waves, but also occurs in electromagnetic waves. And depending upon the design of the antenna and how you can electronically change its electrical length, you can trick the antenna into thinking it's longer or shorter than it is and get the same resonant storage capability of receiving a good amount of the local electromagnetic energy that's passing by at any particular time.
Okay, thank you so much. I really understand it much, much, much better, and I'm putting it all into pieces. So now when I finish reading this book, I'll understand where everything is. You guys, thank you. KG2NSK. Thank you, Roy.
Can I be outrageous?
WB2EV. Well, first I want to thank Sam for bringing the question, participating, and he's more than welcome. I really appreciate the opportunity. Ed, if you want to throw a cherry bomb into the whole thing, please feel free.
Here it is. The whole thing with SWR and resonance and all that is overdone. Here's where the problem is. Transmitters are very sensitive to SWR. If the impedance isn't right, the transmitter final stages will begin to overheat and sometimes will cut back on power. So the problem is you're burning up your transmitter. If it wasn't for that problem, we wouldn't be having any of these discussions.
Well, to a degree, yeah, but to a degree, no. The problem is that ultimately a mismatch, all things being equal, will screw up your efficiency. As far as receiving efficiency, it's far less dangerous. If your receiving signal reflects back into the air and doesn't go down your transmission line and your radio receiver, you just have a little bit more staticky noise. When 1,000 watts going out of your transmitter hits the same reflection, bounces back, and goes back to your transmitter, then all hell breaks loose. So it's a loss of efficiency and a reflection. You're less worried about the loss of energy and reflection back into outer space than you are the loss of efficiency of a transformer and reflection back into your electrical equipment that starts to smoke.
I mean, agree. But let me give you one little caveat on that. You take a receiver with a 40-meter dipole and 2 feet of wire, and you switch back and forth. And I think you'll be surprised at how little the resonant dipole buys you on receive. Will it improve? Of course. Is it anywhere remotely near the difference on transmission? No, because if you try to transmit to that antenna, you're going to burn up your final amplifier.
Comment.
Yes, Ed. Comment. GJE, yeah.
Okay, K2GJE. The receiver has so much gain, 2 feet of wire works. It's a totally different story, of course, at the transmitter end. But then we have a whole series of antennas that are not resonant. We have the beverage. We have the rhombic. We have the loop. Tell me about those.
I once tried to study a beverage antenna. In the end, I gave up on the antenna and went for the literal beverage.
Okay, what happens sometimes on these so-called non-resonant antennas, if you make them long enough, the RF just totally dissipates on the wire. Over.
Yeah, an infinite coax line will eventually leak all the power and give you the SWR.
Well, long enough, you won't even see any SWR.
That's what I mean. It'll give you a one-to-one SWR without a resonant antenna if it's long enough to act as a transmission line. Because if you have... Let me drop it. If you have a repeater, say you have a repeater unit where you have the radio itself on one floor and the antenna up on the roof, the length of the coax will kind of improve the SWR because the loss of the cable improves the SWR. Of course, it's hurting you. It's just a misleading indication, so you have to watch out for that. And this is some of the same thing. The longer the cable, the better the SWR for some good reasons, some bad ones.
True, but we're getting off the subject. If you take and feed a beverage with some open wire line, you take and feed a rhombic with some open wire line, you take and feed a loop with some open wire line or a ballon, they're not resonant. And the amplifier is very, very happy, over.
I believe they actually are resonant. They're just cheap. They don't follow the normal rules.
No, we lose all the RF down the line, and sometimes we even put a little resistor at the end to absorb what we didn't lose on the wire, over.
I think we're talking about both traveling wave antennas and standing wave antennas. Most hams are much more familiar with the standing wave, but most of the antenna designs that you've been mentioning are traveling wave, correct?
Most of us don't have the room for those antennas, unfortunately.
True. They really do get very, 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 very long. And in New York, no one owns that kind of real estate that I know.
I just wanted to give you the other side of the picture. Not every antenna is resident. Over.
Okay, but again, these are receiving antennas. They're designed preferentially to receive, which kind of blows a hole in the concept of reciprocity. But nevertheless, that there are a lot of things that you can get away with receiver front ends that you can't get away with transmitter power circuits. You know, they do not like reflections. And, you know, I keep on trying to explain to people who are obsessed with their standing wave ratio that their dummy load has a perfect standing wave ratio, but I don't think that they want a contest with it.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
Is it Delta Loop resident?
I think so. I mean, if it isn't, please have one of our electrical engineers correct me.
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm fairly sure it is resident.
Well, I was told that, you know, you can build a delta loop or a quad loop, you know, and you would use a certain number of feet of wire on each side. So it might be resonant on the, like on the lower bandwidth, like 40 or 75 or 80, whatever, and the rest would be tuned. So I guess the question is, you know, is it fitted for one band of frequencies, and the rest would have to be adjusted by tuner?
It depends on the particular antenna. You know, there are trap antennas. There are all kinds of combinations of permutations.
I was talking about the loop antenna, delta loop or quad loop.
Yeah, which one of the 1,000 designs that now exist of either of those?
Well, a delta loop has three sides. You know, you feed, I guess, in the middle or one of the corners. I guess the idea is that, you know, if you make 100 feet on each side, somehow it would be resonant on a certain band of frequencies. I don't know how it would work with a quad, but I guess my question would also apply for a quad antenna that is cubical, quad, on a higher frequency.
These are just antenna designs. You have to take each one individually. There are no generic rules other than the classics of you take a dipole and it resonates. And all of these derive from that, and they start playing games, and they find if you do this, you know, the third harmonic is also resonant. You know, the odd harmonics are resonant. You can play all kinds of games with an individual design, but you have to go by the design. You can't make up general rules.
Yes, Sam. By the way, I agree with Ed. A lot of antennas that are particularly complicated in structure, like a G5RV, have a whole bunch of different modes that radiate and act as different types of components. At one point, it's part of the antenna. At another point, it's a stub that transforms impedances. So complex antennas can have multiple multimodal complications that produce resonances in weird places. But Sam, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I don't want to seem like I'm really out of it. I'm really getting confused, but I'm not. Thank you, Ed. I got a 60-foot wire dipole, okay? and I can do 10 meters, 6 meters, 20 meters. But I can receive 40 meters if I'm saying it right, right? If my radio has 40 meters, I put on 40 meters, I can receive 40 meters on that 60-foot wire. How come I can't transmit 40 meters on that same length of wire?
Okay, let me just see that I have this. Okay, I'm sure Ed will finesse this better than me. We kind of said it before, but I'll kind of shrink it down. There's a difference between receiving and sending. When you receive, you're receiving a very small intensity signal from the air. Electromagnetic waves are going through buildings, bodies, all kinds of things. And so being non-resonant doesn't mean that none of the electromagnetic energy goes into the antenna. It means that a smaller amount than if it was resonant goes into that. So that smaller amount is enough to get down into your receiver that has a very high gain circuit that can then amplify that weak signal and let you hear it. The flip side is more problematic. In the flip side, you're transmitting, say, 100 watts of power at your transmitter. When it reaches that mismatch up on the antenna and the signal gets reflected, rather than the reflection just dissipating into air where it's not going to cause any problem and it was so low intensity to begin with that it wouldn't, you now have something like, you know, 90 watts of electrical power reflecting back into your transmitter that is not designed to take in power. It's designed to push it out. So that's the easiest way I could suggest you think about why receiving is so more tolerable than transmitting for a non-resonant antenna.
Got it. Okay. So I can receive it. It might be weaker with a short dipole, but when you're transmitting on a different frequency that's not required on that dipole, you're going to get a lot of connected signal. I understand it now. Thank you.
KD2, WOT, comment.
Yes, Chris.
So, I mean, the more fundamental problem is the impedance mismatch. I mean, and that's the reason for the reflection. So, you know, if you can put a tuner in line with that wire and be able to match the 50 ohm impedance that the transmitter wants to see, you certainly can transmit. I don't know. Maybe it's just a little bit better than a dummy load, but you certainly would be able to transmit.
A quality antenna does fantastically well.
And let me just see that I have it. Although I agree with Ed, you will get arguments on 75 meters. There are a group of people who think that antenna tuners are just a grift, a con artist, to fool you into thinking that it's working, because it's fooling your transmitter into thinking it has a 50 ohm of impedance path, and so it behaves and doesn't send out any alarms. I disagree with that. I agree with Ed. An antenna tuner is a very, very useful piece of equipment. Now, again, there are other factors beyond a impedance match and a standing wave ratio. It is very possible to have your coax cable detached from your antenna and yet have your antenna tuner match it to 50 ohms of impedance at the end. So you'll have a standing wave ratio of 1:1, and you'll have no real radiating device. So you'll have basically a dummy load. So although impedance matching, and which is another way of saying a 1:1 standing wave ratio, is important, there are other components to antenna theory that people have to keep in mind as well.
Another comment?
Certainly, Ed.
If you look at my HF logbook, you'll find there are a number of DX stations, mostly in Europe, that gave me good signal reports on 20 meters using my 40-meter dipole with an antenna tuner, quad erect demonstratum.
Okay, I could understand that.